Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 4th of February 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. We do like to do live versions of this show, but unfortunately we are not able to do that every week, so this one is actually pre-recorded. But I am very pleased to say that I do have my co-host with me today, the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Patriarch, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Hey, Sven. I'm well, thanks. Thanks for having me back. I'm all right. It's a Sunday and we've been going for a walk today and chilling out, really. So it's been good.
Nice to hear. Did you get a chance to have a listen to the episode I did last week, which was narrating from book Israel's Lost Empires? What did you think of that? Was that information that was new to you? Had you heard any of that before?
I heard some of the main talking points, but obviously you went over them in greater detail, just to kind of establish the core roots and the obviously the distinction between the northern tribes, the offshoots of the northern tribes compared to Judah and that. So it was interesting to know the central roots and established the established colonies, basically. And also I found interesting is how a lot of the information on the kind of old world or the Americas was kind of kept secret, or not secret but hidden, because of that they assumed that Greece didn't know about it.
Yeah, it's like they deliberately just hidden all the achievements of the Phoenicians and the Carthaginians, and not just that, but hidden the fact that white people were in America thousands of years ago. They just wanted to hide it before Christopher Columbus. They wanted it to just be that Christopher Columbus was the first guy to get there. And I think it shows quite conclusively that white people were there, the Phoenicians were there, the Vikings were there, and there's lots of evidence for this. And even 150 years ago, people were being told, well, you're not going to be able to stay at this university if you continue to promote these ideas. It just shows that there's been a stranglehold on historians, and they've been told that they have to just stick to one version of history for a long time now, not just since World War II. So it's good that we've got this stuff, and I know probably some of our listeners probably think British Israel or Christian identity is, maybe it's dodgy, it's not quite accurate, but I mean we're providing all the sources for this, and this is what people believed back then 150 years ago. This was just taken as information that was commonly known. Really, it's only today that people sort of look on the Bible and they look on the Christian identity stuff as if it's not true. And there's just so much evidence for it, particularly that the Phoenicians were the Israelites, and particularly what went on in Carthage. This is why we're spending so long on it. There's so much information about it that is out there.
Yeah, I think I remember one time there was an interaction with a Muslim guy, and in his mindset and how they'd kind of been taught is that if you're kind of white, you were Christian, it was maybe it's a cultural attachment that understanding that they had, but essentially they weren't kind of far off, were they? That it was a very racial, it was a religion very rooted in race, and same, so I guess same with the Islam, really. If you were kind of that region, Arab, you were Muslim, same thing.
Well, we were known as the Christians before we were known as the white race. In fact, we were known as the Christians before we were known as the Europeans. And I know a lot of nationalists wonder where they can find good nationalist history. And British Israel didn't get everything right, but their history is always told from a patriotic point of view. And there is a lot that they found out, which is just not included today in academia. And it's worth looking at these British Israel books, even if you don't go along with it or you don't go along with Christian identity, you're still going to find a very well-told patriotic history that is told from white people's point of view by looking at them. And there is a lot of books available. Covenant Publishing is the company that produced them in Britain, and Artisan Publishing is the company that produced them in America. So if any of our listeners are looking for patriotic history, that's where you really want to go to find it. I haven't found much patriotic history being told by anybody else, to be honest. It's just Christian identity.
There's other talking points you can go along with as well, which are starting to be touched on by, you know, a broad range of historians, paleontologists, and even a lot of science is starting to understand that, you know, for example, Noah and is the patriarch of a single race, you know, rather than every race stemming from Noah. And I think this kind of knowledge, hopefully, in more years to come, will become common knowledge, because it's something which needs to be kind of distinguished between, you know, the modern current version of the Bible and what's actually true.
Well, Shem, Ham and Japhet, they can all have only been one race, because they were three brothers. And the church has always traditionally told us that Japhet was European. Well, if Japhet was European, that meant that Shem was European, and Ham was also European by race. I mean, they may not have originated in Europe, and according to the biblical story and the legend, they all came down from the ark, basically, and it was their people that colonized the world. And it tells us what the names of these peoples were, and we can trace them back in history, which is what we've done. Anyway, getting back to today, we're going to be talking some more about Carthage, and particularly about child sacrifice today. Last week, we looked at the Carthaginian Empire in its entirety, and we looked at it from a Christian identity author. And this week, we will be taking a closer look at the human sacrifice aspect of it, and we'll be taking secular sources for today's episode. Greco-Roman sources reference child sacrifice, such as an attempt at Tyre to revive a custom of sacrificing a boy during Alexander the Great's siege of Tyre in 332 BC, recorded by the 1st century AD Roman historian Quintus Curtius Rufus. So what they're talking about there is Tyre in Phoenicia rather than Tyre in Carthage, but it was the same people. As we learned last week, the Carthaginians were referred to as Punics, but it basically just meant that they were the Phoenicians that were in North Africa, to differentiate them from the Phoenicians that were in what is now Syria. And the church historian Eusebius in the 3rd century AD quotes from Philo of Byblos's Phoenician history that it was a custom of the ancients in great crises of danger for the rulers of a city or nation, in order to avert the common ruin, to give up the most beloved of their children for sacrifice as a ransom to the avenging demons. And those who were thus given up were sacrificed with mystic rites. Kronos then, whom the Phoenicians call Elus, who is king of the country, and subsequently after his decease was deified as the star Saturn, had by a nymph of the country named Anabret an only begotten son, whom they on this account called Ledad, the only begotten being still so called among the Phoenicians. And when very great dangers from war had beset the country, he arrayed his son in royal apparel and prepared an altar and sacrificed him. And that's from Eusebius of Caesarea, Preparatio Evangelica. So there's a few things here that I want to pick up on. It's Kronos, the origins of Saturn. Saturn is the Latin name for him. The Greeks and the Romans, they both took their ideas of gods. They took them from the Phoenicians, and this is why we have the story of Hercules, the Greek story of Hercules, which is basically of Samson from the Bible, because it was the same people.
Well, Kronos is, again, the mainstream understanding is that it's a Greek god. Even in kind of media today, like there's a game called The God of War, a famous game on the PlayStation. Kronos was just one of those gods in there. It's just kind of part of Greek mythology, but, you know, they've totally overshadowed the Phoenicians, clearly.
Yeah, it originated with the Phoenicians, and Kronos, of course, is known for eating his children. And is also associated with time, and time causes everything to turn to dust, doesn't it? And this idea of sacrificing your children, we don't like to think of doing that sort of thing as white people. We think, well, that's a bit savage. That's the sort of thing that you associate with tribes that never actually came out of the Stone Age. But we
just convince ourselves it's a bunch of cells and get away with it that way.
We do the same today, don't we, with abortion. We end up killing the children in the womb, thinking that that's going to lead to some kind of improvement in life for the mother. And it was the same thing back then. They would kill a child and think that that was going to lead to an improvement. What they're saying here is that in times of war, they would do this. But by the time we get to Carthage, they seem to be doing it just to try to gain some kind of improvement in their day-to-day living. Greco-Roman sources frequently criticize the Carthaginians for engaging in child sacrifice. The earliest references to the practice are the references in Sophocles' Andromeda, fragment 122 from the 5th century BC, and the pseudo-Platonic dialogue Minos, probably from the 4th century BC, while the late 4th century BC philosopher Theophrastus claimed that the Syracusan tyrant Gelon had demanded that the Carthaginians abandon the practice after he defeated them in the Battle of Himera, 480 BC. So this is going on 2,500 years ago. I mean, it's not that far back that that we were still doing things like this, sort of talking about 500 BC here. And there are other white people that are insisting that the Carthaginians have to stop doing this. And that it is wrong to be doing this.
And you're saying the origins of this obviously comes through Baal worship, right?
Yeah. through the Canaanite influence. I mean, this is what the Canaanites were accused of doing in the Old Testament. And there were Canaanites that were amongst these Israelites. We know that when the Israelites took over that area in Phoenicia, they pushed the Canaanites out into the hills and the hill country, and they eventually made their way back in, and the Israelites adopted some of their practices, which is why in the Bible God gets very angry with them, and they end up getting kicked out of their country. And King Josiah got rid of all the temples to Baal. Mm-hmm. But this Baal worship idea managed to make its way to Carthage. At first, the Carthaginians were very moral. And then after they'd set up their colony, they then descended back into these pagan practices, which included this sacrifice of children. The first detailed account comes from Cletarchus, an early 3rd century BC historian of Alexander the Great, who is quoted by a scholiast as saying, "Phoenicians, and above all Carthaginians, worship Kronos. If they wish to achieve something big, they devote a child of theirs, and in the case of success, sacrifice it to the god. There is a bronze statue of Kronos among them, which stands upright with open arms and palms of its hands facing upwards above a bronze brazier on which the child is burnt. When the flames reach the body, the victim's limbs stiffen and the tense mouth almost seems like it is laughing, until with a final spasm, the child falls into the brazier." And that's from this Cletarchus fragment.
It's quite sick, isn't it? But it's the in terms of the statue, it's pretty much a replica, isn't it, of the original Baal statues, just replaced with Kronos.
Yeah, and also it's similar to the image that we think of today of Moloch with a bronze statue with his arms upright.
Moloch is what I meant.
And we'll get into that as well, because this Moloch, it's actually Kronos, and for some reason we refer to it as Moloch, but it's basically that image that we think of when we think of Moloch was actually Kronos. The 1st century BC Greek historian Diodorus Siculus writes that when the Carthaginians were besieged by Agathocles of Syracuse in 310 BC, the Carthaginians responded by sacrificing large numbers of children, according to an old custom that they had abandoned. They also alleged that Kronos had turned against them, inasmuch as in former times they had been accustomed to sacrifice to this god the noblest of their sons. But more recently, secretly buying and nurturing children, they had sent these to the sacrifice. And when an investigation was made, some of those who had been sacrificed were discovered to have been substituted by stealth. In their zeal to make amends for the omission, they selected 200 of the noblest children and sacrificed them publicly, and others who were under suspicion sacrificed themselves voluntarily, in number not less than 300. There was in the city a bronze image of Cronos extending its hands, palms up, and sloping towards the ground, so that each of the children, when placed thereon, rolled down and fell into a sort of gaping pit filled with fire. So it seems that this was quite an old custom that they had, and instead of sacrificing their noblest children, they'd been sacrificing slaves that they had bought, and because of that, they believed that they were losing in this battle. And it really is quite twisted, isn't it? It's quite
dark, very dark. It's, I mean, to think that, you know, some of our ancestors could go that dark. But then again, you know, World War One, I guess, was a dark time in terms of death, war, and kind of mindset that people went through. It was, I think certain beliefs can really get people to do some dark, sinister things, you know, beyond what they even thought they're capable of themselves.
Yeah, and if everybody believes in something and everybody else is going along with it, you know, most of us will just go along with it as well. We don't want to stand up and be different from the crowd, do we?
Yeah, there's that famous psychological experiment. I forget what it's called now, Malheiser or something like that, Malheiser experiment, where there's, you know, subjects and they've got their heads above them, like scientists, who basically they have to administer electric shocks to the people behind the glass, and they're told, you know, the set amount that's or the safe amount that they can minister, and anything over that is going to be very damaging, and they can, you know, and they're told to kind of go one higher, and, you know, it's how they actually go along with it. But it's I guess a lot of it's to do with the kind of hierarchical structure and as well, and officials and what the tone is set from the top, basically what I'm trying to say is, and you know, people under it, they absorb their morals and ideals from that. So, you know, if the source is corrupt from the head, it kind of permeates down to the body.
Yeah, the fish rots from the head down, I think, is a is a Russian saying. And another thing to point out here as well is today they say that this may have just been black propaganda against the Phoenicians, but it doesn't appear that there was much criticism of it at the time. And what we're talking about here is reports that were written in the 4th and the 5th century BC. So they were written at eyewitness accounts. They were written at the time that this was going on. They weren't written centuries later. And people weren't writing and saying, well, this is a load of rubbish, this isn't true. So it sort of stands uncontested that this was going on, but they have tried to minimize it today, and there are historians that claim that this didn't happen. Elsewhere in his work, in Library Book 14, Diodorus claims that wealthy Carthaginians would purchase infant slaves to offer in lieu of their own children. The writer Plutarch also mentions this practice, and he was 46 to 120 AD. He says, with full knowledge and understanding, they themselves offered up their own children, and those who had no children would buy little ones from poor people and cut their throats, as if they were so many lambs or young birds. Meanwhile, the mother stood by without a tear or a moan, but should she utter a single moan or let fall a single tear, she had to forfeit the money, and her child was sacrificed nevertheless, and the whole area before the statue was filled with a loud noise of flutes and drums, so that the cries of wailing should not reach the ears of the people. So it sounds like they had a sort of frenzy of music going at the same time. So you would have had
drums beating down.
Yeah, and a psychological effect on the people.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine that? Just a full-on kind of ceremony with drums beating down and just getting people into a hysterical state. And, yeah, just that emotional charge just passing through the crowds. Yeah, crazy.
Probably rather like, you know, you go to a rock concert today, only back then it would be a similar thing, but there would be like a human sacrifice that was taking place at the same time. You know, a lot of the things that we think are quite innocent today have origins in quite horrific
But in order to charge a state where, you know, they're kind of immune to the hysteria that the children are going through, the music must have been quite dark and sinister and kind of gritty and raw, you know, in order to just draw out of them that dark emotion.
And you can also see that what the Israelites were doing was quite different to this as well. Their mentality was different to this. They didn't have the fertility rites and the fertility orgies and the human sacrifice, but it was very tempting for them to get involved in all of that, which is what these Canaanite tribes were doing around them. And the Canaanite tribes themselves, although they originated from a white man, they ended up interbreeding with the aborigines of the land that had these magical beliefs. That's where they that's where they actually came into this. Several Christian authors allude to the practice in the early centuries AD. The Christian apologist Tertullian, about 200 AD, states that although the priests who sacrificed children had been crucified by a Roman procurator, that holy crime persists in secret. Another Christian writer, Minucius Felix, claims that Punic women aborted their children as a form of sacrifice. I mean, that's very similar to today, isn't it?
Well, yeah, well, it's
exactly
identical.
The same. Exactly the same.
For same whatever thing. Reasons, we don't know, but it's still ultimately murder, isn't it?
And the Romans put a stop to it. I mean, they thought this was a disgusting practice. And you do wonder how long it had been going on for, and, you know, because you hear the similar sort of things that were going on in Egypt, you know, throwing people to the crocodiles, that sort of thing.
Hmm.
Well, I brought up Moloch earlier, so if we have a look at how Moloch fits into this. Traditionally, Moloch has been understood to refer to a Canaanite god. However, since 1935, scholars have debated whether or not the term refers to a type of sacrifice on the basis of a similar term, also spelt Moloch or MLK, which means sacrifice in the Punic language. This second position has grown increasingly popular, but it remains contested. Among proponents of this second position, controversy continues as to whether the sacrifices were offered to Yahweh or another deity, and whether they were a native Israelite religious custom or a Phoenician Canaanite import. And of course, we would suggest that they were an imported custom, because that's what the Bible tells us. It tells us it was an imported custom. But it could well be that this term Moloch, it referred to the sacrifice rather than the god, because they haven't been able to find a Canaanite god that was actually referred to as Moloch.
True, yeah. I mean, well, it definitely couldn't have been offered to Yahweh, because they were judged for it, weren't they? They were pretty much kind of dispersed, and the sword was brought upon them for killing the children. So it's not something which is a recognized offering at all.
Of course, a critic might bring up the fact that Abraham was asked to sacrifice his son Isaac. But the reason for that is Abraham had already been promised that his son Isaac was going to father many nations. So it was a test of Abraham's faith in the promise that God had made to him. So when God said to him, well, you need to sacrifice your son to me, Abraham had faith that something was going to happen that would actually prevent that. And what it meant was that Abraham set the altar up, and when you set an altar up and you set up a sacrifice, you give that, whatever the sacrificial victim is going to be, is then handed over to God, and it becomes God's property. So Isaac was then handed over to God as God's property. He was put on the altar, so he was anointed. Mm-hmm. And then this lamb appeared that apparently had been ready since the dawn of time, in a prefiguring of Christ's sacrifice on the cross. Yeah. And the lamb was put in place of Isaac. So it wasn't a common practice of God to say, well, I need you to sacrifice your children to me. It was a test of Abraham's faith. And also, this was done at a time when these human sacrifices were taking place in Egypt. And it was a way of saying, I don't want you to sacrifice your children. I am the actual creator God. which was Yahweh, and he said, and I don't want you to sacrifice children. And after or around about this time when Abraham sacrificed Isaac, the human sacrifice stopped in Egypt, apparently. Mm. So this was a way of saying it.
Just a point on when you were saying that the sacrifice is a becomes a belonging. The Israelites were often referred to as my heritage throughout the Old Testament, you know.
Well, they were an anointed race. So because Isaac was anointed and he was put on that altar, that meant that anything that came from Isaac's loins was also anointed and owned by God. So that's where this bit comes into it, of this holy people. That's why they were holy, because they were anointed and they were put on the altar. They were owned by God, like Yahweh's portion. Another phrase.
And I don't, when you understand the Bible in those terms, I don't see how suddenly everything could become spiritualized, you know, and you know, a blood covenant be obsolete. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, you can also see where modern day confusion sets in, and people say, "Oh, well, yes, look, here's Yahweh asking for a human sacrifice." And there is a later instant as well where there is a king, and he says, "Well, I will sacrifice the first thing that I see that comes to me if I win this battle." And he wins the battle, and the first thing that he sees is his beloved daughter. And there is a strand of thought which says that it's actually the translation that is wrong there. And what it meant was that his daughter was put forward as a nun, basically. And he said that he would sacrifice whatever came to him, but that he would give whatever it was to God. So his daughter wasn't actually sacrificed. She was handed over to God. I mean, at the time, you could have a son, and the son's head would be shaved, and he would be a Nazarene. Or if you're a woman, they would have the equivalent of going off to a nunnery, you know, which is the same tradition that we continued once we became Christian.
Yeah, I guess context is key, isn't it? So he's sacrificing in the sense of giving up something. You know, you can sacrifice, you know, foods, or you can sacrifice, you know, treasure and your earnings, in order to give them, you know, as an offering. So it's not always rooted in shedding of blood.
So they were sacrificing grandchildren, and there were quite a few British kings that who had daughters, who had princesses, and they gave them to the church, and they became nuns. So they were basically doing the same thing. And really, I guess, unless... the term which is actually used in the Bible is this MLK term, then it's not actually going to mean a human sacrifice. And it's interesting that they have MLK, which is Melki, which is also linked to kingship. And you have the Melchizedek, Melchizedek, and this word itself means king. And I think it might tie in with mighty as well. So there's this side to it as well. So it's very strange that we've assumed that Moloch actually meant the name of the god. Since the medieval period, Moloch has often been portrayed as a bull-headed idol with outstretched hands over a fire. This depiction takes the brief mentions of Moloch in the Bible and combines them with various sources, including ancient accounts of Carthaginian child sacrifice and the legend of the Minotaur. As we've seen earlier, it's actually Kronos that was doing that. It was whose hands were upheld this brass image, and the where the bull comes into it, I'm not quite sure. Perhaps to do with the golden calf, and maybe that's why when they were depicting images of this 200 or 300 years ago, they decided to depict it as a bull because they knew that the Israelites were worshipping the golden calf. Maybe that's where it tied in.
Yeah, possibly. What would you say to people that claim that that the Phoenicians were essentially Canaanite because of the practices, and you know, and say that they not necessarily adopted them, but they were Canaanites themselves?
Well, we know that the Israelites were following these practices. We know that they were following this Baal worship. And at the time that Israel was in drought because of the Baal worship, that's when people set off from Phoenicia and set up Carthage. And the Bible is, right, full of instances of the Israelites doing these practices, basically, these Canaanite practices. And we know that there were Canaanites amongst them. And we know that the Carthaginians used all these biblical names, that their judges were named the Shofetim, the priests were known as the Kohenim, and they had all these Hebrew names that they were using. They weren't using Canaanite words and Canaanite names, they were using Hebrew names and Hebrew customs, yeah, mixed in with these Canaanite ones. So there were Canaanites there as well as Israelites. Moloch has been figuratively used in reference to a person or a thing which demands or requires a very costly sacrifice, and a god Moloch appears in various works of literature such as John Milton's Paradise Lost in 1667, Gustav Flaubert's Salammbo in 1862, and Allen Ginsberg's Howl in 1955. It's quite a common image, isn't it? Moloch. Before 1935, all scholars held that Moloch was a pagan deity to whom child sacrifice was offered at the Jerusalem Tophet. And I think we mentioned the Tophet a while back, two episodes back, because in Carthage they found all of these Tophets, these places where these child sacrifice was actually offered. And the word appears in the Bible that this was going on in Jerusalem. So again, we know this was going on in Jerusalem under the wicked kings. And the wicked king married Jezebel, who was from Phoenicia. She was a Phoenician princess. She had to have been an Israelite princess, really, or you couldn't have married her. But it was her daughter that went on to found Carthage. So we know that was the traditions that they were following by this time. So the child sacrifice was offered at the Jerusalem Tophet. The medieval rabbinical tradition understood Moloch as closely related to other similarly named deities mentioned in the Bible, such as Milcom, Adramelech, and Anamelech. So we have this Melech word there. We also have Amalek, which was the name of one of the Canaanite tribes. So this Melech word itself is tied in with the Canaanites, it's tied in with sacrifice, but there isn't actually a name of any gods, and the rabbis tried to tie it into these other words. The medieval rabbinical tradition also connected Moloch to reports of ancient Phoenician and Carthaginian child sacrifice. Both of these rabbinical ideas were taken over by early modern scholarship. Some modern scholars have proposed that Moloch may be the same god as Milcom, Adad-Milki, or an epithet for Baal. And it's tied in with Baal, isn't it? Baal worship. It was a sacrifice to Baal or to Kronos.
Yeah. I mean, that's the impression I got, to be honest. I definitely thought that they were kind of one and the same. I don't know why I got that impression, but I think Baal is the most commonly common god associated with the Canaanites. So it kind of just seemed, more than likely.
Well, it also means Lord, doesn't it? Baal also means Lord. So it was like an epithet that they would put before the names of these gods. So you have Baal Hadad, which sort of meant Lord Hadad. Okay.
In what language?
Canaanite language.
Right. So it's not Lord in Hebrew?
No, in Hebrew it's Adonai.
Right, okay.
Which is close to Odin. Okay. Adonai, Odin, it's got the same letters, basically. G.C. Hyder and John Day connect Moloch with a deity Melech, attested at Ugarit, and Malek, attested in Mesopotamia, and propose that he was a god of the underworld, as in Mesopotamia, Malek is twice equated with the underworld god Nergal. Day also notes that Isaiah seems to associate Moloch with Sheol, and Sheol was the Hebrew word for the underworld. The Ugaritic deity Melech, which is MLK, also appears to be associated with the underworld, and the similarly named Phoenician god Melquart, literally king of the city, could have underworld associations if city is understood to mean underworld, as proposed by William F. Albright. Hyder also argued that there was also an Akkadian term, Malaku, referring to the shades of the dead. So there's all these sort of links there with this word to do with the underworld as well as to do with the sacrifices. I'm trying to think of another word, like Melquart, king of the city. There's another one that I can't think of that also means king that's tied in with it. It's strange that it's got this similar sounding word to the king as well. But I guess it's they're sacrificing to a god, and the kings were seen as God's representatives on earth, weren't they?
Yeah.
The notion that Moloch refers to a deity has been challenged for several reasons. Moloch is rarely mentioned in the Bible, is not mentioned at all outside of it, and connections to other deities with similar names are uncertain. Moreover, it is possible that some of the supposed deities named Melech are epithets for another god, given that Melech can also mean king. The Israelite rite conforms, on the other hand, to the Punic Melech rite, in that both involved the sacrifice of children. None of the proposed gods Moloch could be identified with is associated with human sacrifice. The god Melech of Ugarit appears to have only received animal sacrifice, and the Melech sacrifice is never offered to a god named Melech, but rather to another deity. So interesting here, they say that this Israelite rite that's talked about in the Bible, it conforms to, or it's exactly the same as the Punic rite, which was taking place in Carthage, but they don't make the connection that that's because it was the same people. That's why they were doing these same rites. They were Israelite people there. In 1935, Otto Eisfeldt proposed, on the basis of Punic inscriptions, that Moloch was a form of sacrifice rather than a deity. Punic inscriptions commonly associate the word Melech with three other words, mur, or lamb, bl, citizen, and dm, human being. Bl and dm never occur in the same description and appear to be interchangeable. Other words that sometimes occur are busa, flesh. When put together with muluk, these words indicate a muluk sacrifice consisting of. The biblical term Yamalek would thus be translated not as to Moloch, as normally translated, but as a Moloch sacrifice, a meaning consistent with uses of the Hebrew preposition la elsewhere. So again, it's saying that it's a type of sacrifice, and then at the end of it, you can say whether it's a lamb or a citizen or a human being that's actually being sacrificed there.
So did they maintain the sacrificing of lambs, do you think, amongst the Carthaginians?
I should imagine they probably had animal sacrifice as well. Mm. They must have done if they actually had the word lamb that's attached to it as well. I mean, Punic inscriptions commonly associate the word with three other words, one of which is lamb.
Yeah, because, I mean, we have three words lamb together kind of remind me of almost like a Christ-like sacrifice. So I just wonder if that was a remnant of their past biblical kind of sacrifices, which were, you know, fully justified.
Yeah, I should imagine so. Among scholars who deny the existence of a deity Moloch, debate remains as to whether the Israelite Melech sacrifices were offered to Yahweh or another deity. Armin Lange suggests that the binding of Isaac represents a Moloch sacrifice to Yahweh, in which the child is finally substituted with a sheep, noting that Isaac was meant to be a burnt offering, and of course we've covered this earlier. This opinion is shared by Stavrakopoulou, who also points to the sacrifice of Jephthah of his daughter as a burnt offering. And that's the daughter that I referred to earlier, of the king, where they suggest that it's a mistranslation of the word there, and it wasn't a burnt offering at all. It was just him sacrificing his daughter, as in she was then becoming part of the equivalent of the church back then, the same as kings were doing right the way up until about 400 years ago in Britain. They would offer their princesses up to the church. Frendo, while he argues that Moloch refers to a god, accepts Stavrakopoulos' argument that the sacrifices in the Tophet were originally to Yahweh. And of course, that they can't be originally to Yahweh because he's absolutely against that throughout the Bible. Durell argues that although Melech's sacrifices were offered to Yahweh, they were distinct from other forms of human or child sacrifice found in the Bible and were a foreign custom imported by the Israelites from the Phoenicians during the reign of Ahaz. And of course, the Phoenicians were Israelites, but they were also surrounded by Canaanites, and they also used the Canaanites as slaves. And there's one particular bit where the Canaanites themselves come and make a treaty with the Israelites, and they pretend not to be Canaanites. And because the Israelites have made this treaty with them, they're not allowed to kill them. So they had them as hewers of wood and drawers of water. And that also fulfilled Noah's curse that the sons of Canaan would be slaves to their brothers. So the Canaanites became slaves.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point. I wonder how they could have pretended to have not been Israel, Canaanites, or would they pretend to be the same people? And would that mean that they didn't look too different?
Yeah, well, they didn't look too different at the time. Canaan was a white man, but he was the offspring of an illicit union. He was the offspring of the union between Ham and Ham's own mother when they all got drunk on the vine and blacked out, basically. And Canaan was the offspring. So he came from an illegitimate union. So there were no wives that really could be provided to him, although he was white. And I think he managed to get some wives from Ham and probably from his immediate family. But then they also, because they were a corrupt line from the start, they started interbreeding with the other peoples that were already in the area. The peoples right. that we're told in the Mesopotamian texts were created by the Anunnaki and all these other gods that mixed together the black-headed people with sperm from the gods and created all these various different races. Well, you've got all of them that are around, and the Adamites should not have interbred with them, but Canaan and the offspring from Canaan, they did interbreed with them, but there would have been white ones amongst them. And I mean, it would have been difficult to tell. And I think what they did there is they claimed to be a different tribe, basically.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, I forget what the name of the tribe was, but they claimed to be a different tribe and they made this treaty with them.
What I find interesting about that is, though, even after they found out, they still honored their covenant with them, didn't they? It didn't become null and void. They still honored it, which I find quite fascinating, really.
Well, they had to. I mean, otherwise it meant that their words had fallen to the ground. And if you were an important person and you spoke something, that was the truth, and that had to stand. That's why they couldn't undo laws. When you get to the Book of Esther, and the Persian king makes a law about going after the Jews, and then he wants to change that law, he can't change that law. Because it's been spoken from his mouth. It has to take place. So they have to come out with some way to still carry that out and also avoid happening what they wanted to avoid happening. And I think that's still the same today. When the king makes a law and speaks a law, it's not supposed to be changed. It's supposed to stand for all time. And when you got lower people like nobles, when they would speak a blessing or they would speak a curse, that was taken very, very seriously. As we see throughout the Bible, there are blessings and curses. And once a blessing has been made, that you can't take it back. Or once you make a curse, you can't take it back. You can't say, well, it was the wrong person, so I want to undo that now. It's been done.
Yeah. So I guess your word and the truth really kind of stands for a lot in terms of, you know, goodness and what's right, and then contrast that to modern day where everything is pretty much just you surrounded by lies, and even from the media things are just riddled with lies and deception. It just kind of goes and puts in perspective, you know, how evil the times we're living in are.
Oh, it really does. And also it makes you, because sometimes people say, well, you're looking at this stuff that was written 2,500 years ago, they could have just been making it up. you know, they wouldn't have just made things up back then, because the idea of lying was absolutely abhorrent. You know, you had to tell the truth. If you didn't tell the truth, then, you know, what sort of a man are you?
It was worth your life, wasn't it?
Yes. Your life would be over. You'd have no more honour because you'd lied. It was taken very, very seriously. You know, we had these awful things going on, like human sacrifice, but at the same time, people were honourable, and the reason why they did this human sacrifice is because, you know, they had faulty information. They thought that this was going to be helpful to them. The same as the women today think it's going to be helpful to them to abort their babies. It's the same thing. Getting into the Carthaginian wars here now. Greek cities contested with Carthage for the Western Mediterranean, culminating in the Sicilian Wars and the Punic War over Sicily. While the Romans fought three wars against Carthage, known as the Punic Wars, Punic meaning Phoenician in Latin, as Carthage was a Phoenician colony grown into a kingdom. And as we saw last week, it didn't just grow into a kingdom, it grew into an empire. It was a huge empire, and they prevented the Greeks and the Romans from getting out past the Pillars of Hercules, and that's why they had no knowledge of America. The Phoenicians did. I mean, that they controlled that whole area, and they were merchants, basically. They were traders
Did we ever, I might have asked it before, but obviously kind of discovering the Americas centuries later, we don't see much of a remnant of white people there. So we can safely assume that they just kind of blended in with any other, Aboriginal peoples.
Yeah. No, and that's why when Columbus went out there, he discovered that there was people with ginger hair and green eyes, and similar to what we discover when we go to Afghanistan now, and we see the remnants of Alexander the Great when he was there. Mm-hmm. When you think about these Phoenicians, they were amazing sailors. They're actually very similar to the British. You know, they were great sailors and great merchants and traders. A lot of similarities to the British, and they had we know that they had relations with the British, because this Greek guy Pytheas, when he was traveling around Britain, he saw the British people bringing the tin out to the Carthaginians, to the Phoenician sailors on the ships there, that were then taking it back to Carthage, and then on into the rest of the ancient world. And these other ships couldn't actually get out. I mean, it was amazing that this Pytheas managed to get out, and he was the first one to actually get out and observe this going on, basically. Because the Phoenicians were the top dogs. But because they were doing all this human sacrifice, it was taken away from them. The fall of Carthage came at the end of the Third Punic War in 146 BC at the Battle of Carthage. Despite initially devastating Roman naval losses and Rome's recovery from the brink of defeat after the terror of a 15-year occupation of much of Italy by Hannibal, the end of the series of wars resulted in the end of Carthaginian power and the complete destruction of the city by Scipio Aemilianus. As we heard last week about Hannibal, he made his way in, and it's amazing that he didn't just destroy Rome, to be honest. And the author last week was suggesting that the reason for this is because of the prophecy in Daniel about the Roman Empire. And if the Phoenicians had destroyed them at the time when Hannibal was there, that wouldn't have happened. And there's no actual explanation for why he didn't.
And so you think there was a divine intervention, or just...
Well, it could be, because it's just unexplained why he didn't destroy them.
Maybe they were more wounded than they let on, and they wanted to recoup. And by that time, Rome recouped quicker. I don't know. It's hard to see what the other side was like.
Well, you can also say, well, what about when Hitler had the British at his mercy, and he allowed them to all go back, didn't he? Because he thought that Churchill would be honourable and stop the war, because Hitler had the upper hand there, and he didn't want to kill the British. So different situation.
Yeah, I think there was a similar situation in Russia as well, but he called off the Japanese. Maybe that was for other reasons.
Yeah, I, I, I'm not quite sure what was happening with the Japanese, but he did, rather than imprisoning the British, he allowed them to all go back on fishing boats when he had them at his mercy, basically.
You don't hear that in the press, do you?
No. The Romans pulled the Phoenician warships out into the harbour and they burned them before the city, going from house to house, capturing and enslaving the people. Around 50,000 Carthaginians were sold into slavery after this battle. The city was set ablaze and razed to the ground, leaving only ruins and rubble. After the fall of the city of Carthage, Rome annexed the majority of the Carthaginian colonies, including other North African locations such as Volubilis, Lixus, and Chella. Today, a Carthaginian peace can refer to any brutal peace treaty demanding the total subjugation of the defeated side. So there were lots of North African colonies back then that were white colonies that were filled with white people. And, and Rome took over Carthage. And for, I don't know, almost 1,000 years up to that point, it had all been white in North Africa. And when you hear about Africans from 2,000 years ago, that's what it's talking about. Or 3,000 years ago, it's talking about white people. It's talking about these Carthaginians.
At what point were the more sub-Saharan Africans kind of started to blend in and mix? Was it during the fall of Rome or just a little bit prior to that?
After that, I think. Not until the Muslim invasions, not until after the 6th century BC. Because what you had is the Arabs would then go and pick up the black Africans, sub-Saharan Africans, and then you had this slave trade and they would bring them across the Sahara and use them as slaves. And I think there was some mixing in Egypt, wasn't there? And there was some mixing in Ethiopia. But the Ethiopia is lower down. But the sub-Saharan Negro didn't really make his way across the Sahara on his own until, 100 years ago, 200 years ago.
What, you mean further towards the north?
To the north, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you had Arabs there, didn't you? And they were stuck there right down at the bottom. So maybe we should look into that at some point, actually, is how the black Africans spread out from where they were.
Would be interesting.
But I do want to finish up today with a final reading about the Phoenicians from Tracing Our Ancestors by Frederick Haberman. And this will lead us up to Spain and Britain. And next week's episode, we're actually going to have a look at martial arts. And then after that, we'll have a look at Britain. So I just wanted to go through a couple of pages here from Tracing Our Ancestors by Frederick Haberman. Only when we trace the origins of the Phoenicians to the descendants of Noah and follow the central stem of that root through the line of Heber and Abraham can we lift the veil of mystery that has hung over the Phoenicians throughout the ages. Then can we understand who were the leading spirits of the Golden Age of Phoenicia and of the mythical age of ancient Hellas. At that time, no Jew had ever been born, yet the Jews of a later age, and until this day, have succeeded in beclouding this issue and have blinded the minds of our scholars. Chambers' Encyclopedia, under the article Phoenicia, remarks, "The Golden Age of Phoenicia, during which her colonies, her manufactures, and her commerce were in this most brilliant phase, seems to have waned simultaneously with that of Judea. As Solomon in the latter, so does Hiram in the former, mark the end of that peace and happiness which made their countries rich and glorious as no other country of their day." So what he's saying there is that the Phoenician Empire sort of took off after David and Solomon, which as we know, the Phoenician Empire was part of Israel.
Yeah.
"Surely the secret at last is out," says Professor H.B. Hannay. The Cyclopedist admits that with the demise of Solomon and Hiram, the so-called Phoenician Age practically came to an end. The Cyclopedist is, however, in error in referring to Judea, for the Kingdom of Judea started only after Solomon's death. And the very reason that Phoenicia's greatness had passed was that the northern kingdom of Israel, the house of Isaac or the Bethsack of the Assyrian tablets, became harassed by the armies of Assyria. and all those who did not leave Palestine voluntarily were finally driven into Assyrian captivity between the years 747 and 676 BC. So the Phoenician Empire sort of falls at about that time. And at that time, you still have Carthage, which was going for another 300 years as part of the Israelite Empire. Yes, the northern Israelites, the Beth Sack, were the heroes of the Golden Age, its creators and sustainers. It is when they are suddenly and tragically hurried into oblivion that, lo, the activities and glories of the so-called Phoenician Golden Age mysteriously shrink, wither, and fade away too. Glory departs, but it reappears elsewhere. From time to time, as the centuries roll on, it shines forth anew in diverse countries to which the disintegrated and scattered communities of the Bet Sack can be proved to have found their devious way. Not, however, as communities known to be Hebrews, but under different names, names familiar enough to the historian and the schoolboy, which few would ever dream of associating, and some of which have in fact never been associated, with the Hebrew race. This, of course, is anticipating the argument, but the digression enables us to catch a glimpse of the probable reason why, during the centuries which have come and gone since the captivity referred to, the Hebrew element or aspect of the stirring epoch which has been misnamed the Phoenician Golden Age has dropped so entirely out of sight and remembrance. That was H.B. Hannay. It is this oblivion of the name of Israel that the psalmist had in mind when he said, "They have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel be no more in remembrance." Of course, we must not overlook the people who lived in Palestine when Israel entered the land, the people of Syria and the Hittites, all of them known as Phoenicians, for they also were the descendants of Noah, but of Ham. What pure religion they once possessed had long been displaced by Baal worship and its abomination. When, therefore, the new blood of their kinsmen, the Israelites, came among them, the latter easily predominated, but Israel all too easily adopted the pagan religion of the Canaanites and the Hittites. After Israel had disappeared from Palestine, the Phoenicians founded Carthage, Venice, and Marseille, and we have every reason to believe that the Latin nations of Europe are descended from them, and so also are the southern Irish. When we read in Scripture of the wealth and glory of Solomon's kingdom, it is obvious that that kingdom reached far beyond the boundaries of Palestine and Eastern Asia. The reference to a 3 years' journey of the ships of Tarshish would indicate that those ships went to far distant countries in pursuit of trade and colonization, and we were referring to that, saying that they must have been actually been going to America. They're going on a 3 year journey. Both Solomon and Hiram, king of Tyre, maintained an eastern and a western navy, as we see from 1 Kings 9:26 and 10:11 and 22 and 11 Chronicles 8:18 and 9. The word Tarshish appears in the Old Testament quite frequently. In the roster of the sons of Japhet in the 10th chapter of Genesis, we find Tarshish as a son of Javan. On ancient maps, we find Tarshish or Tartessus as the name of southern Iberia or Spain. Otherwise, the word Tarshish is connected with shipping and colonial enterprise. Of Jonah, we read that he took a ship to Tarshish. Hastings' Bible Dictionary states that Tarshish stood for the commerce of the west, as Sheba and Dedan stood for the commerce of the east. All the Bible references seem to indicate that Tarshish represents Israel's colonies in the Isles of the West, i.e. in Spain and in the British Isles. In Isaiah chapter 60, verse 9, we read, "Surely the isles shall wait for me, and the ships of Tarshish first to bring thy sons from afar." The reference here is to Israel's restoration to Palestine, and when the ships of Tarshish shall bring back the people. And in the 38th chapter of Ezekiel, which deals with Russia's assault upon Palestine, we read that the merchants of Tarshish with all their young lions shall challenge Russia at that time. Most students of prophecy are agreed that Tarshish here and her young lions represent Britain and her colonies with the USA. And that's the first time that I've heard of that one. Maybe we should look into that some more. Now, also, this the Isles of the West... It also means the Isles of the Sea, And when that is referred to in the Bible, it's specifically talking about the British Isles. They were the Isles of the West. That Spain was a Hebrew Phoenician colony is indicated by its ancient name of Iberia, the land of the Hebrews, Iberia. The name of the Spanish river Ebro is also derived from Eber, the grandsire of the Hebrews, while that of the river Guadalquivir was originally Guadalhibiri in Moorish, meaning the river of the Hebrews. In the golden age of Phoenicia, Iberia was a Phoenician colony, and from its gold and silver mines, Solomon imported most of his treasures. These mines were worked by the Danites and Gadites, or Cattai, in the interests of Hiram and Solomon. Some years ago, a stone was discovered near Gibraltar, telling in Phoenician of a certain Adoram who was sent there by Solomon to collect tribute. In 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 18, we read that Adoram was the collector of tribute for Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. The chief Phoenician seaport in Iberia was Gadira or Gadiz from Gad, the modern Cadiz, where most of the gold and silver was loaded, and it also served as a halfway station to the British Islands or Cassiterides, also derived from Cassi or Catti. The Gadites were with the Danites, the most enterprising of the Phoenicians. They were continually gadding about. The Cassiterides were also spoken of as the Tin Islands, because of the tin that was brought from there, particularly from Cornwall, and which was shipped from the Bay of Penzance, or Phoeniciana. It is a mistaken idea of some scholars to assume that the name of Cassiterides is derived from some oriental name of tin. On the contrary, tin ware was named after the Cassiterides, for instance, casserole. Numerous ancient writers testified to the colonization of the British Isles in their days. This is Herodotus's testimony. I cannot speak with certainty, nor am I acquainted with the islands called Cassiterides, from which the tin is brought to us. It is nevertheless certain that both our tin and our amber are brought from these extremely remote regions in the western extremities of Europe. And of course, he's referring there to the Cassiterides, Britain for the tin, and the Baltic for the amber. Several other ancient writers refer to the British Isles in their days, yet our modern professors ignore their evidence. Polybius, the Greek historian of the 2nd century BC, writes, "Some will inquire why, having made so long a discourse on Libya and Iberia, we have not spoken more fully of the outlet at the Pillars of Hercules, nor of the interior sea, nor yet indeed of the Britannic Isles, and the working of tin, nor of the gold and the silver mines of Ibernia, Ibernia, or Ireland." And of course, the reason why there wasn't much written about it is because the Phoenicians prevented them from getting out there, and they didn't write about it because they didn't want these other peoples, the Greeks and the Romans, getting to these resources that they had access to. And as we've traced all of this back to the original people that went over for the tin were from Assyria. That's the oldest record that we have, is them coming over from Assyria and getting the tin. Phoenicia is right next to it. So all this time, they sort of kept the other nations out. Aristotle, in his De Mundo, states, "Beyond the Pillars of Hercules, the ocean flows around the earth. In this ocean, however, there are two islands, and those are very large, and are called Britannic, Albion, and Iarni, which are larger than those before named. They lie beyond the Celtic, and there are not a few smaller islands around the Britannic Islands and around Iberia." Pliny says, "The whole of the Roman Empire was supplied with metals and tin from Britannia. Greece, too, was supplied with tin and sundry metals from the same source as early as 907 BC. But the most valuable evidence of all concerning the Western Isles is supplied by Ptolemy. They were peopled by descendants of the Hebrew race, who were skilled in smelting operations and excelled in working metals." This confirms all that has been said so far. Considering all this testimony, we see that as soon as the Phoenix of Israel began to set in the east, a new home had been appointed for them in the west, in Britain, or the land of the covenant, because BRT is the Hebrew word for covenant. Therefore, we read in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 10, "Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel and will plant them, that they may dwell in a place of their own and move no more. Neither shall the children of wickedness afflict them any more, as they did before time." And at the time that 2 Samuel was being written, the Israelites were in the land of Israel. So that's talking about a new place that they will move to, which we would contend is Europe, of course.
But Israel was never actually their own, technically, because they didn't fully kick everyone out, did they?
No, they didn't. So, they disobeyed. They were supposed to make it into a complete ethnostate, and they didn't. They kept some of the Canaanites alive. At first they did. At first they obeyed God, and they removed all the peoples from the land. But then later on, after Joshua had died, they allowed them back in again. And, you know, they started mixing with them, as we read about, which is why they were punished like this. And, of course, there were others that had left before then, the ones that had left while Moses was still in Egypt, Zarah, and started off Troy, and Latinus, he was linked in there, that actually started off the Roman Empire. So you had all this excitement that was going on in the Near East, and with Babylon and Judea and Samaria, and you had colonists that were moving out from there into Europe. And as the cities in the Near East were crumbling and the Assyrian deportation, you had Greek and Rome that was taking off, and that finally wiped out the Carthaginians. And then we had the Roman Empire, and then at the end of that we had the European one. And the European one is obviously the furthest away from the start, which, as we've pointed out, it all started off in Mesopotamia. That was the first civilizations, and then they spread out from there as the colonists and the adventurers and the pioneers. They worked their way out from that fertile center, looking for the resources. And you know, this explains why Britain isn't talked about that much, is because the Phoenicians kept the path to Britain closed, and the ships couldn't get out. As I say, it was the first one that got out was Pythias, and I think 450 BC. And he observed what was going on. He observed the Phoenicians or the Carthaginians picking up the tin from the Cornishmen. It's interesting that this Cassiterides, and we still call it a casserole dish today.
Or a casserole. Oh, right. Is that really? Is that where we get casserole from?
That's what Frederick Haberman was pointing out there.
I do like a bit of casserole.
Yeah. Well, as I say, we're going to end up looking at Britain, but in the next episode we're going to look at martial arts and have a brief detour into that, I think. But we'll leave that here for today. I think so. Thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more patriotic history for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.